In the United Nations, you have poor nations and rich nations. They say that the most powerful bloc in the UN are the African-Asian bloc. These are the poor nations. Yet they carry more weight in this political body than the nations do who have all the money. Why? Because no matter how wealthy America is, she only has one vote. No matter how wealthy Russia is, she only has one vote. Whereas all the poor nations in Africa who have just emerged into independence, they have each a vote too. And they stick together and are able to outmaneuver the rich nations. This isn't by having independence and the right to vote in the political world body, it has enabled the dark nations to band together and use the strength of their ballot to force the wealthy nations, which are the white nations, into giving more independence to other nations who are still under their jurisdiction. You and I have to look at this and understand this, that the ballot is as powerful as the bullet.
Of course, that was the voice of Malcolm X, Ballot or the Bullet, who on February 21st was the anniversary of the 50th anniversary of his assassination. It's almost hard to believe for those of us a certain age that it's been 50 years ago that Malcolm X was slain, and still controversial over who killed him, how it happened, and more. But there's a lot to talk about that moment, but more importantly about how Malcolm X plays in the 21st century world, and all of that complexity. So we are joined here to do that. Please join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation, or write to us here, talk@standardshow.org. We want to hear your thoughts and ideas on Malcolm as we talk about this and all that came from him. We are joined by Dr. Peniel Joseph, who is professor of history and founding director of the Center for the Study of Race and Democracy at Tufts University, author of numerous books, including Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, A Narrative History of Black Power in America, Dark Days, Bright Nights, From Black Power to Barack Obama, and his newest book, Stokely, A Life. Good to have you back, Peniel Joseph.
Hey, thanks for being here.
Dr. Uhuru Williams is with us, who is professor of history at Fairfield University, author of Black Politics, White Power, Civil Rights, Black Power, and Black Panthers in New Haven, and editor of A Constant Struggle, African-American History from 1865 to the Present, Documents and Essays. He's also an advisor on the Civil Rights Reader, putting the movement back into teaching civil rights. And Dr. Uhuru Williams, good to have you with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Mark.
And Michael Denzel Smith is joining us as well, who is a contributing writer to The Nation, a blogger at TheNation.com, the Nobler Fellow at The Nation Institute, a freelance writer and social commentary on his work on race, politics, social justice, and pop culture, and more, and works, you can see his writing in The Guardian, Ebony, The Griot Root, and Huffington Post. And Michael, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
And you all can join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in this conversation. And I mean that as, and I say this as somebody who is as a young man, when Malcolm was assassinated, and was one of those standing outside at his service, because nobody could get in. There were so many people there waiting to say their farewells to Malcolm X, that it was 50 years ago, and the world we lived in at that moment was a world in some ways too similar to where we are, but in some ways really different than where we are today. I mean, let me throw this out and just see this in terms of the how we speak about Malcolm in today's world. I mean, we're at that point in a world where segregation was ending, but deindustrialization was happening, that this black middle class exploded onto the scene in America because of the end of legal segregation. But at the same time, 20 million African Americans, at the very least, were left in deindustrialized neighborhoods that were destroyed. They have some of the worst poverty in the history of this country and isolation. And people debate over the relevance of Malcolm to all that, given when he was killed and what was exploding at that moment. So let's begin there. Dr. Williams, why don't you start us off?
You know, I think Malcolm was particularly important to that moment for any number of reasons that you touched on. I think a lot of times we think of Malcolm as someone who offered solely a critique of the civil rights movement, and we, in some sense, do him a disservice by capturing him in sound bites and not looking at the breadth of his philosophy with regard to the condition of African Americans in the United States. And a lot of what he talked about were methods for combating not just police brutality and inequality and governmental services, but literally poverty. And the Nation of Islam at the time had a program, of course, to deal with that. But Malcolm, moving forward, even when he broke from the Nation of Islam, was looking at issues of poverty and issues that would have been relative to deindustrialization with the Organization of Afro-American Unity. So as a thinker, you know, we have to think of Malcolm being much more expansive in the way that he was approaching issues affecting the African-American community, and talking really in a sense about being international in scope and thinking about the ways in which the problems affecting black people here in the United States were also affecting Africans, people of African descent across the globe. So in that sense, Malcolm speaks very powerfully to us today in the conditions that we find our communities in, whether we're talking about Black Lives Matter, whether we're talking about poverty, the problems with education. Malcolm remains a powerful symbol and a powerful voice on all those issues.
Michael?
Yeah. And in some ways, I feel like we do Malcolm a disservice in naming him a civil rights leader, because, you know, it's a way, I think, now to defang people and depoliticize them, the way that civil rights movement has kind of been subsumed into the broader American narrative of progress, and it has been de-radicalized. And what I think Malcolm serves as is this human rights activist with a black nationalist lens. And I think that that's really important now in terms of being able to see the rights of humanity through the lens of the most marginalized, and not having to get under a banner that would say something like "All Lives Matter," right? So it's very specifically saying "Black Lives Matter," and that's what Malcolm was saying then, in different language, and speaking to you know, black audiences about black self-worth and about black love and expressions of that, and loving oneself and one's history in spite of the things that you've been told about what that history is. And I appreciate Malcolm even more in this moment, whereby he could speak to global politics and speak to issues of poverty, knowing that these things affect a broad range of people, but still see them and speak about them through his very specific black national lens.
Dr. Padil Joseph.
Yeah, no, I'll take it from I agree with everything that's been said. In terms of my own scholarship and the way I teach Malcolm, and Malcolm is one of the central figures in my first book, Waiting Till the Midnight Hour, and there's a long chapter on him in my second book as well, and I'm writing a book right now on Martin and Malcolm. The way in which I think about Malcolm, certainly local, national, and global. But if we look at Malcolm X, born in Omaha, Nebraska, May 21st, 1925, the first thing we have to understand is that his parents are Garveyites. So they're followers of the Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, who are pioneering activists who go to Omaha and then Lansing, Michigan, to spread this word of radical political self-determination. And the Garvey movement is the largest black mass global movement in modern history. 3 to 5 million folks. It stretches to Africa, Latin America, the Caribbean, all corners of the United States, and it's a movement for radical social political self-determination, but also for revolutionary Pan-Africanism. There's different wings of that Garvey movement, including a left and right wing. So you've got people like the African Blood Brotherhood, you've got African Socialists, you've got so many different people who are connected to the Garvey movement. And from that Garvey movement, you've got somebody like Elijah Poole, who's a sharecropper born in Georgia, who becomes the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and that's coming out of the Garvey movement. Once Garvey is arrested and then eventually deported from the United States, you have many different former Garveyites who found different religious, nationalist, and political sects, and that's how you get the Nation of Islam. So there's a through line through Malcolm's father and his mother, Earl and Louise Little, to Elijah Muhammad, to Malcolm Little, to Malcolm X. So the important thing about, when we think about Black Lives Matter or this issue of mass incarceration, Malcolm was in prison from 1946 to 1952. Malcolm's father had been murdered by white supremacists in Lansing, Michigan. Malcolm's mother was had a nervous breakdown, and Malcolm's siblings have to deal with the juvenile justice system and juvenile social welfare system for the rest of their young lives. And so Malcolm becomes a juvenile delinquent because he's searching for family. He is always bright. He's always eloquent. He's one of the top students in his elementary school, but then he tells them he wants to be a lawyer, and they say that the only thing you can do is be a carpenter because of his race. So when we think about Malcolm, Malcolm is part of a generation, even in the 1930s and 40s, of young black men who can't find sustaining and dignified labor in the United States. The problem is even worse now, 70 years later. So he had walked the talk even before the epiphany and the transformation in prison. So the interesting thing about Malcolm is certainly he's a black power activist. He's a revolutionary. He's a Pan-Africanist, revolutionary anti-colonialist and anti-imperialist. But he's also somebody who is a working-class black hero. The way in which I always position Malcolm is as the most important working-class black activist to ever be produced in American history, and really global history, because he, in a very specific way, identifies with African-American men and women who've been incarcerated, who've had their families broken up, who've been victims of racial violence, but he transcends that at the same time because he says that his story is going to be a global story. So this idea of charging the United Nations with genocide, which had been started in the 1940s with people like Paul Robeson and W.E.B. Du Bois, and the Council on African Affairs, Malcolm takes up that banner. But the first thing he does when he starts the Muslim Mosque number 7 on West 116th Street in Harlem is start reaching out to ex-cons and local people, people he had sold marijuana to. You know, he had been in Detroit, he had been in Lansing, he had been in Roxbury in Boston, he had been in Harlem, and he starts reaching out to the so-called black underclass.
Right.
During the World War, that he had known during the World War II years, and really starts organizing. So he's an organizer and not just this radical critic. He's an organizer for, yes, initially black nationalism, but eventually just revolutionary self-determination.
So let me pick up a point here. And it's a thread here before we go to the phones of 410-319-8888. We want to hear your thoughts on Malcolm and Malcolm as we should talk about him today. But there's an interesting through line that Peniel just came up with. And I'd like to kind of wrestle this through line for a moment about what through line exists from 65 to 2015. Because Marcus Garvey was a powerful through line for the growth of a black nationalist movement on many fronts. And many people circled in and out of Garvey's life and movement and were surrounding it and were part of it. You could not deny it at the moment of its being, especially in the black community. So what is that through line for today, Uhuru? What is that through line from Malcolm to now?
I think it's powerful, and I love the way that Peniel strung that together because, quite frankly, it's a through line that we've seen represented in the programs of organizations like Marcus Garvey's Universal Negro Improvement Association, and the fact that Malcolm's parents were Garveyites is central. It deals with three things that I think remain essential in the African-American community with regard to where we are in this contemporary moment. One is the question of black identity, and Peniel spoke eloquently to that, as did Malcolm. The importance of understanding our history and being very much connected to the idea that people of African descent have a much larger history, a much larger diaspora to connect to understand that our problems socially, politically, economically are very much interconnected, and so therefore problems in the West Indies, problems on the continent of Africa, problems here in the United States have a through line in them of racism and racial inequality, and that we need to band together in order to address those questions. And then thirdly, and I think this is probably most important for today, the question that Peniel broached in terms of the search for dignified work, but also encounters with the state, and the fact that we look at the importance of Malcolm X as someone who, again, helps us see the interconnectedness of emancipation at the moment of emancipation in 1865, a 13th Amendment that outlaws slavery except for the punishment of a crime. We see the use of the criminal justice system to control and corral African Americans, particularly African American men, throughout most of the 20th century, Malcolm's own life being touched in that way. And in this contemporary moment we find ourselves in, where we can talk about Eric Garner and Michael Brown as victims of police violence, but more importantly, the violence that we see visited on black and brown bodies in the system of mass incarceration in this country. So Malcolm, in that sense, is very much someone who we can see a through line in African-American history, but also global black oppression.
And Michael, this, your quick thought on that. I want to go to the phones, go to this call coming in from Northern Virginia, other places.
Yeah, I think what Peniel's saying is really important about Malcolm as a black working class hero, right? So it's an alternative to the idea that, you know, black liberation movements have centered the idea of black middle class and what the issues that affect them are. And that, I think that bleeds into today, where you have a Malcolm who reaches out to people who are formerly incarcerated, reaches out to people who are on the streets, and further marginalized, even economically and in these silos of the ghetto. And I think that now it's the natural extension of making a movement that centers those people that have been pushed to the sides and that have not been part of these movements before because of an idea of presenting oneself as the most respectable and trying to win white people's hearts and minds through the presentation of the most respectable Negro that is deserving of rights. So now what we have is a movement that is embracing the margins and embracing the differences and embracing people that aren't traditionally thought of as the most deserving, right? So that is expanded to include like black queer folk and black trans folks who are constantly left out of these conversations about whose rights are we fighting for. And so Malcolm is fighting not just for, you know, the desegregation of the lunch counter, if you can afford to go and sit at that lunch counter, but the fact that you're locked up or that you are locked out of economic progress and you're locked out of economic affluence and those type of issues. So we're seeing that play out now in a much broader way.
Let me open the phone to get some thoughts from our listeners, and as we kind of pull out some of the incredible things our three guests have said here and pursue them for the rest of the program, 410-319-8888. Brian in Northern Virginia, you're on the air.
Good morning,
Brian.
Thank you very much for having this program. Malcolm has been an influence on me throughout my entire life. Reading his autobiography in high school, being turned onto it by a white teacher, in fact, in the English class, long-term substitute, was one of the key things that has made it, had a great impact on my life. But what I want to focus on here is Malcolm's death as a tragedy. And the tragic aspect of his life is that he was assassinated while he was in a transformational state. And what that has done in his life afterwards is given all types of people to make the opportunity for all types of people to make claims on Malcolm, that he was moving in this direction or in that direction, or he would have been this or he would have been that. But one thing that, you know, and everybody has been claiming, socialists, communists, even capitalists, and, you know, all kinds of folks have claimed Malcolm. Two things we can definitely say for sure. And one is that he was definitely of the Muslim tradition. And there is really no one clear Muslim tradition. I really appreciate what I believe was Camille Joseph brought out, is that that Malcolm's Islamic tradition is an African-based, an African-American-based Islamic tradition that he was coming out of. And in terms of his transformation at his death, he was coming into, I don't want to say an Arab form of Islam or what have you, but he was coming into another understanding of Islam. And who knows where he would have been at that point. But the second point that I really want to make in terms of his transformation is that Malcolm represented and the civil rights movement and black people in this country in particular represent the consciousness of America. And it is our quest for justice in American society that could be the litmus test for America standing up to and upholding all of its ideals and principles that are put forth in its constitution.
Right.
But Malcolm went further. Malcolm went further to expand that, as your guests have pointed out and many others in the past, that he was a human rights activist. And we can only imagine where things would be and the types of programs and the type of ideas and the types of things that Malcolm would have been doing and leading if he would have continued to live. And his spirit continues to be in existence throughout all these human rights struggles that we see going on in the world today.
Brian, I pretty deeply appreciate the call and your thoughts, and I do want to pick up on this theme, because one of the things we don't talk a great deal is is Malcolm X and the Islamic world, and Malcolm X as a Muslim, and the split that took place for him with Elijah Muhammad, because Malcolm became in many ways too political for the Nation of Islam, talking about anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, raising the question of socialism and African socialism that he did. And then when he created this Muslim Mosque, Inc., the same time he created the Organization of African-American Unity, it's what people like W. Dean Muhammad, the son of Elijah Muhammad, took off and ran with, creating a Muslim movement in this country on the heels of that. And we were, W. Dean Muhammad was a guest on the show many times before he passed away. So, I mean, that this is an interesting aspect of Malcolm's life, Michael Denzel Smith, that I think we do not talk about enough.
Yeah, and that split is interesting because it points to the fact that the Nation of Islam was actually a very conservative organization in its outlook. I mean, they were fitting into a sort of black capitalist ideology that was advanced by Marcus Garvey, right? And Malcolm is splitting with that and finding ways to express his newfound ideas around a communal sense of economic justice and racial justice through his faith in Islam. And I think that we don't talk enough, like we're always talking about the role that faith plays in movements, particularly black liberation movements, but excluding the narrative of Islam playing a role in the ideology of brotherhood that Malcolm particularly learned when he took his Hajj, and that transforming him so that he was more open to the idea of working across racial boundaries toward the same end goals, though. And so I think that, yeah, we have to include the narrative of Islam in our black liberation studies that in a way that Christianity sort of lords over it.
And Yehuru, we have about 2 minutes. We have to take a very quick break, but do you want to kind of take us there with some thoughts on that as well?
No, I completely agree with Michael. I think it's a wonderful observation in the sense that even today, there's such negative perceptions about Islam, especially in the aftermath of 9/11. And yet this was a faith that spoke very powerfully to people of color in this country, African-Americans in this country, going back to Timothy Drew and the Moorish Science Temple, of course, the black Muslims, and certainly Malcolm's own faith. And so I think it's as important to emphasize King's Christianity as it is to talk about the Muslim faith and its impact on Malcolm and his growth and development.
And we got to have a quick break, but I do want to come back and pick up on that point, Peniel Joseph, because I think that this is the piece when he created Muslim Mosque, Inc., what was happening then to Malcolm and in the Muslim world. And I think that that's particularly relevant today as we kind of wrestle all this. We're going to take a very quick break, and come right back. We're going to go out with Backlash Blues by Nina Simone, who was born on February 21st, 1933, on the day, of course, Malcolm was assassinated. And if one of the things Malcolm did do, I think, as we can talk about this when we come back, is how he deeply affected the cultural warriors of this country, like Nina Simone and Amir Baraka and more. We'll come right back. Stay with us.
All you got to offer is your mean old white backlash. But the world is big, big and bright and round. And it's full of folks like me who are black, yellow, beige and brown. I'll kill the first mother I see. My life has been too rough.
I'm Mark Steiner. That's Nina Simone. Four women. And already we're back to our conversation on Malcolm. I have to remind you the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you, and money comes back in the end. www.mecu.com. Pardon me, gentlemen. Sorry for coughing. Before we go back to the phones at 410-319-8888, as we talk with Dr. Yehuru Williams, Dr. Peniel Joseph, and Michael Denzel Smith about Malcolm X in this 21st century. Peniel, I was going to jump back to you about talking about Malcolm as a Muslim and the powerful role that played both politically and spiritually, and whether, and I think it does speak to us now.
Well, yeah. One thing, I think I agree with what people are saying, but I think we should dig down deeper, because when you think about Malcolm and the Nation of Islam, I understand what Michael is saying about it as a conservative organization, but when you look at the nation between 52 and 64, when Malcolm's a part of it, he turns a group that has, you know, several hundred members to, into this, this national and international organization that has over 25,000. And one of the things we have to remember is that all organizations are very complicated. So you're going to have different factions. Before Malcolm comes and helps organize the Nation of Islam into this multi-million dollar entity with a newspaper, Muhammad Speaks, that has a circulation of over a half a million, it's a very small entity. You know, all of the messenger, Elijah Muhammad's sons and family, were working odd jobs. He set it up where eventually they just were working for the organization. So there becomes three centers of power, Chicago, New York, and Arizona, Phoenix, where the messenger's living because of his asthma. And so when we think about Malcolm and the internal struggles in the organization, what we have to understand is that there are many people within the organization who are very sympathetic to Malcolm's political radicalism. And also, what Malcolm does in 64 with the Hajj, he had been to Africa in 1959, but he didn't make the Hajj because he didn't want to upstage Elijah Muhammad, who hadn't been there yet. When we think about Malcolm, his political evolution doesn't just happen in 1964. He realized even before that that he could make cross-racial coalitions and cross-ideological coalitions. The reason he wasn't necessarily articulating that is because he was the national representative of an organization that didn't want people to overtly be political and go to boycotts and organize. He still was connected to different political groups in New York City. He was connected to the Amsterdam News. He was connected to 1199 and hospital worker strikes that were those 46-day strike in 1959 that Malcolm's connected to. He's connected to the UN demonstration in 1961, where Maya Angelou,
right,
and Mary Baraka, and
right,
Rosa Guy in,
right,
January of 61, after the assassination of Patrice Lumumba. So he's connected to Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, Max Roach and Abby Lincoln. So it's important to remember that this is somebody, and this is what I document in my dealing with Malcolm, because I deal with Malcolm as a human being and political figure and organizer, but if we follow the thread on a day-to-day, it doesn't jibe with the way in which people make these sweeping judgments about Malcolm or the NOI. So the interesting thing is he was always criticizing American presidents. He's certainly a black power revolutionary, but he was always involved in the civil rights struggle, and he's always a human rights activist. He's always an anti-imperialist. He comes out against the Vietnam War before King, before Stokely, before SNCC. So when we think about Malcolm, he's this amazingly complex figure, and so we have to really study him, you know, on a day-to-day basis, and also the people who were around him, because there are an amazing group of activists, Max Stanford from the Revolutionary Action Movement, people who would go on to become Black Panthers, John Oliver Killens, who was part of the Harlem Writers Guild. There's an amazing group of old black left and black nationalists and black Pan-Africanists and new black left, Pan-Africanist, Marxist, socialist, who congeal around Malcolm. So one of the things I've argued is that Malcolm X in the 1950s and the early 60s is the common denominator for the Black Power revolt. Okay, people like William Worthy, people like Gloria Richardson, so many different people. But it extends into the civil rights movement because he connects with Fannie Lou Hamer. He connects with SNCC. He's in Tuskegee and Selma, and as early as the 1950s, he's in Miami and different parts of the South organizing Muslim mosques. So if you follow his career on the day-to-day, you come up with a much more complex and panoramic understanding of who he was.
I think that's really good, you know, what you're laying out now. We're looking to a whole other program just around that. I think it's really important. I remember, just a quick personal aside here before I go right to the phones, as a young man in Cambridge, Maryland, in the civil rights movement in Cambridge, Maryland, I should say, Gloria Richardson, I remember the day that she told Martin Luther King not to come to Cambridge. And I remember part of her reasoning in that day was because of Malcolm and her love of what he did. I think that I'm going to get to these kind of cultural political connections, the question I have for the three of you in just a moment. But let me go to the phones right here at 410-319-8888. Get a couple of quick calls in, then come back to my three guests. African in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, I want to honor Malcolm X he would say, Assalamu alaikum, which means may peace be unto you. He was not bent on war. He was not bent on violence. He was all about standing up for your rights, as any black man would. And he also, you know, was cleaning our people up. But the negative part was, you know, making it seem like Elijah Muhammad, you know, they had a beef. You see, the negative part, they always do our people like that. But this Saturday, Charlie Duggar is having something at the Arena Players for Malcolm X. Check the time.
I will check that out.
Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam. We will check that out. Charlie Duggar is a good guy. Let's go to Thomas in Baltimore. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Thomas.
Yes, I think I have a question and a comment. First,
sure.
First, my comment, and it sounds like everyone on your panel is pretty well-versed on Malcolm, and I'm sure all of us would agree that he was a mindset and a personality that was constantly evolving with an insatiable appetite for knowledge and information. And just as we notice throughout Malcolm's years how he condemned, when we talk about slavery, speaking of religion, how Christianity had been imposed on our ancestors during the time of slavery, I guess to make us more subservient. The point I'm trying to make is when you look at the history of Islam in Africa, and all of us know the nationalist side or the black nationalist side or pan-Africanist side of Malcolm X, particularly his associations with Dr. Kwame Nkrumah from Ghana and many other African countries that fought for independence, and his affinity for Patrice Lumumba, if he would have eventually come out against Islam when you consider the history of it, its ugly history of it in Africa and how Islam was imposed on African people. And my last part of that is when you think of his also affinity for Paul Robeson, who was a big nationalist, and how Paul Robeson also traveled many countries in Africa, and he spoke out against colonialism and all of those other ills that kept our people down. I'm wondering if Malcolm, looking at Islam, the history of it, if he would have stepped away from it and more so explored the traditional religion of Africa. I'll listen to your answer off on the radio.
Really interesting question. Uhuru Williams, why don't you jump in that first?
It's a great question, but I think it's a question that speaks to the complexity that Peniel was trying to get at in his observations about Malcolm as a person. Certainly the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, as a comparison, was aware of the atrocities committed in the name of Christianity, and Malcolm, as well-versed as he was in terms of his reading and appreciation for history and culture, would have been well-versed about the history of Islam. I think his acceptance of the religion was that of an individual who was able to divorce a faith system away from those who implemented it and used it for political purposes, and yet he himself also, because of his association with the Nation of Islam, was doing that to a certain extent. As Peniel points out, or documents in Waiting to the Midnight Hour, we have to look at Malcolm as someone who was both a representative of Islam, but also of a political organization, an organization that had a social structure to it in the nation that had its own rules, dictates, and Malcolm was required to go along with that. So in a lot of ways, it's not so much that you're looking at individuals who might have been chased off their faith because of atrocities committed in the name of that faith system, but individuals who, for whatever reason, came to believe that that faith system offered the best alternative for people of color at that moment. And for Malcolm, it was Islam.
Islam does have a very complex relationship with Africa, but Africa also has a complex relationship with Islam, I think, as well, that our caller was talking about. I mean, we don't have time to get into now, but I mean, you know, Michael Denson Smith, I think these are the kind of things to explore really deeply are important, I think, for younger generations to figure out just who Malcolm was.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to assign any type of ideology to Malcolm that he didn't express in and say that he would have come to this conclusion about
right.
Islam based on his studies. But I think it's fascinating to think about it simply because of who Malcolm was, and the story of Malcolm was one of transformation, and it was one of engaging new ideas. And that's part of what's left out of his story. And I think that I'd be excited to have read Malcolm's work engaging with black feminism, right? I would have been excited to read Malcolm's work engaging with queer theory. theory with all of the things that have happened since his death. And I think that's one of the more tragic aspects of him being taken away and assassinated in the way he was, is that we didn't get to experience all of those things coming from such an incredible mind.
We should also note, though, that, you know, Malcolm does record in the autobiography his encounters with groups like the Seventh Day Adventists, who offered assistance to his family after his father was killed. And he talks about, you know, having somewhat of a negative interaction with those types of groups. And we should also recognize that it was his brothers and sisters, his family, that had engaged with the Nation First and had written to him in prison about the wonderful message of the
right.
Honorable Elijah
right.
Muhammad. So that familial connection is also important in appreciating his religious preferences and choices.
So I want to tell you, before we, Curtis, hold on, I'm going to come to your call in just a minute, but I want to raise another issue here that kind of came up a bit before break and go around with the three of you about this, which is Malcolm X's influence on the kind of radical, revolutionary black cultural world in this country that has defined a lot, at least, and defined a lot from the late 60s and 70s, and still defines things. I mean, whether his influence on Amiri Baraka, on people like Nina Simone, who we listened to during the break, and I think that there's a deep connection here, because often that's how politics, aspirations, and the intellectual viewpoints come out. They come out culturally. They don't always come out in political texts.
Yeah, no, I'd love to. I mean, absolutely, 100%. One of the things we have to remember, and this goes back to Malcolm's time as Malcolm Little. I mean, he was in the juke joints and the jazz joints in Harlem, and he knew those. And he talks about this in the autobiography, that the same guys he was both listening to. There's a point where he's actually an entertainer for a brief period, and Manning Marable documents that. So he by the time he becomes a Muslim minister, many of those same people he knows, and his stature rises politically, he gets all kinds of connections in that cultural world of first music, but then also he knows, you know, Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, certainly Ozzie Davis, Ruby Dee. He knows so many different cultural figures, Maya Angelou, different writers, James Baldwin, and artists, John Oliver Killens, Rosa Gee, so many of the black expatriates who go to places like Ghana. They knew Malcolm in Harlem, and Malcolm then visits them in Africa. So Amiri Baraka and Malcolm have a long, you know, several hours meeting shortly before his death, but Amiri had been watching Malcolm, hadn't been ready to move completely in that direction until after the assassination. But Abby Lincoln and Max Roach in the Freedom Now suite, We Insist, in 1961.
Right, right.
This is all connected. I mean, one of the biggest reasons why cultural figures adore Malcolm, and Ozzie Davis said it, was he was giving people an uncompromising vision of black masculinity, but black political self-determination in a period where that wasn't always feasible, and that wasn't always possible in a public demeanor. But he also talked about culture and the idea that African Americans had been robbed of their culture. One of the metaphors for the Nation of Islam was that black people were in the wilderness, in the searing hot wilderness of America, and they had been robbed of this history that stretched back to millennia. So in a very tangible way, wherever he goes, he has very, very real connections with writers and artists, you know, people, you know, everybody from the Maya Angelous and Nina Simones to just different cultural workers who are younger, who then are going to embrace Malcolm. And certainly the poet Sonia Sanchez,
yes,
is very key here, because Sonia had a very close relationship with Malcolm politically and discusses their conversations and the influence that Malcolm had. And his secular politics, that's the whole thing. Even when he was in the Nation of Islam, people weren't going to join the NOI, but everyone knew, including Elijah Muhammad and these cultural figures, that Malcolm was this revolutionary secular figure. So from that perspective, many embraced his call for radical self-determination, but he also called for a cultural revolution as well.
Michael, as someone who covers the kind of these issues in your generation around social justice, pop culture, and hip-hop, weigh in on that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, he has an impact, obviously, on his immediate peers in the culture of the time, but later he's adopted as a symbol of resistance by the hip-hop generation, and it's not even necessarily his ideology, even though that plays a big role, but him as a figure of defiance and him as an anti-authoritarian figure, like that whole stance of being pushed to the margins and the standing up for oneself and the assertion of oneself really bleeds into hip hop. And you can see, like, even, you know, the iconography of Malcolm X, like being adopted by a KRS-One on the Boogie Down Productions album by All Means Necessary, or, you know, Chuck D in public very much embracing his Pan-Africanist vision of what politics looks like. And, you know, the X hats and T-shirts and all of that, he becomes a symbol of defiance, and he becomes a symbol for people who are looking to stand up for themselves in a system that would continue to marginalize them and continue to displace their own self-worth in means that run counter messages that Malcolm was trying to express to people. So he continues to lord over the culture in a way that even if you don't buy into his ideology, what you can glean from Malcolm and what you can gain from Malcolm is a sense of self that allows you to walk through the world with a sense of dignity and pride.
Before we go jump back to you, Huru Williams, let me go to the phones here, in all fairness, at 410-319-8888 as we talk about Malcolm X, 50 years after his assassination in the Audubon Ballroom, of course, with February the 21st, 410-319-8888. Curtis in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Greetings. I want to say thank you, first of all, for having this show, because I think as a young African-American male who's heavily influenced by some of the speeches that Brother Malcolm gave, and also an active member of the hip-hop community in Baltimore, he's often overlooked or overshadowed by so many other things, especially because his association with the Nation of Islam, or what would be considered, I guess, the non-mainstream thing, which is Christianity in America as it relates to African-American people. But actually, I was going to comment more so on the point of him being an icon in the hip-hop community to this day, how many quotes and how many shirts. And, you know, you see Malcolm very heavily tied to not just conscious hip-hop, but even in some aspects, you know, the so-called rebellious hip-hop. And that's just because Malcolm, if any of, you know, the young men, I'd say, in a certain age demographic in our community, when we listen to Malcolm, we hear a man who, first of all, we have an example of a man who has been to the bottom and gone through transformation and was still in transformation or evolving even at the end of what would be the end of his life. And, you know, Malcolm is just the example of, you know, somebody we can relate to. Almost like I listen to him so much, I feel like he's a second father to me. And he was dead long before I was born. You know, and I just wanted to more so just give gratitude that he's even being mentioned this much, you know, because it almost seems like in our community, especially to young African-American men who really admire his work and some of the things that he stood for, it seems like he's being kind of brushed to the side and written out of history almost. There's no real monument for him and, you know, things of that sort. So I'm just glad to hear that this show is even happening. You know, it really touched me to hear people even go in this deep on Brother Malcolm. And I just want to, you know, much respect to you for that.
Thank you, Chris. I deeply appreciate that. I mean, one of the things we believe in here is that I believe in very deeply is that our history is the key to our future. And so we could not have let this go by on the 50th anniversary of the murder and assassination of Malcolm X without doing that. Uhuru, do you want to respond?
Yeah, I do. I think the caller made a great point about his connection to hip-hop, but you played Nina Simone, Four Women, on
right.
one of the breaks on the way out.
Right.
I think it's important to note the ways in which Malcolm culturally is in our DNA as African-Americans. There's so much about his experience that speaks to the experience of people of color in the United States. And even in that song, when Nina sings about these four women, Aunt Sarah and Sophronia, whose father, whose mother is... raped by a white man. That is so much Malcolm's experience. It's so much of what we see culturally in the literature, even in a play like Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, with the tension between Walter Lee Younger and Benita Younger, and her desire to get a medical degree and return to Africa and use her knowledge in the service of her people. So much of that struggle for black equality in that period is reflected in the literature and reflected in the lives of luminaries such as Gloria Richardson, such as Malcolm X, that it's important to recapture that. I also think it's important, Peniel spoke to the significance of Malcolm as a male hero, and that is very important in terms of the African-American community today. But this is also a gentleman who is the father of four daughters. Lauryn Hill reminded us, resurrecting for a certain extent for the hip-hop generation, the importance of Betty Shabazz and this black feminine ideal, which often is portrayed, at least with regard to the Nation of Islam, as being subservient, and yet there was real power in Betty Shabazz and what she represented in terms of a counterbalance to Malcolm. So there's a power, I think, a resonance. The caller talked about the importance of Malcolm and where he sits. I think it's significant that the first major motion picture to be made really was Malcolm X by Spike Lee. And it was made at a time when groups like Public Enemy and even NWA were, to a certain extent, trying to tap into and to excavate some of that legacy and to apply it to a world in which they found life very similar in their lyrics to what had existed in Malcolm's day. And finding in Malcolm that historical everyman that could speak to their experience as eloquently, as powerful as the lyrics they selected to talk about their own situation.
Let me return to the phones here, and I'm glad the three of you are with us here today for this program. 410-319-8888. Maya in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. My comment is this. As I've gotten older, I've listened more into Malcolm X because listening to him, I do see the figure in him too, like the last caller. And my thing is this, once his mentality changed, was it him telling us with the Nation of Islam to love the faith of the Islamic people without so much embracing the religion of it? Because my boyfriend, he's Muslim, and I agree with so much. And as I've gotten older, my mom's Christian, so I was raised in a Christian household. But being with him, I've been exposed to the Quran. And once I've been exposed to the Quran, I don't understand how Christians can bypass a book that mentions their book. It's like a trilogy almost. Like you have the Torah, you have the Bible, and then you have the Quran. And I feel like Christians stop at the Bible and don't continue. And in order to fully embrace why the Muslim people are the way they are about their faith and the things like that, I feel like in order to get that love, you have to embrace all of it. So in order, you can't just stop at the Bible and say, okay, this is it.
Mm-hmm.
There's another book that literally mentions your book and the stories in your book. And with the whole subservient women thing, I don't see covering up the subservient. As a man, you would want your woman to cover up. I don't completely agree with the whole you have to wrap your hair up and things like that, because I wear afro and I love my bush. But at the end of the day, yes, as a woman, you should want to cover up. You should want these rules. And I do believe that they got rid of him because his words would have empowered the masses so much we couldn't be stopped.
So,
he was going to pull the king and queen out of us.
Well, thank you so much for this call. And I think it's very powerful here to me, Michael Denzel Smith. You can talk a little bit about what Maya was saying, but also the fact that there's so many, I think, bright young people in this world today who are wrestling with different aspects of this and aspects of Malcolm in terms of figuring out where they are and where the future is going.
Yeah, I mean, and that speaks to what Pinnell was talking about earlier about the complexity of Malcolm and that everyone can pull something different to apply to their own lives. I'm not necessarily going to like condone the call for women to cover up as something that's not subservient. I think that that's certainly a whole ideology of sexism that bleeds into a lot of religion and expresses itself in certain cultural mores that are particular to Islam, but you can pull different sexist ideology from all religions. To the caller's point, I guess, you know, you're asking Christians to embrace Islam and Christianity has become a dominant world religion through through, in many ways, violence, and then power has been bestowed upon the Christian ideology and identity in a way that that Islam has not been, or you know, Islam hasn't been able to dominate the globe and global economy in the same way that Christianity or people who identify as Christians have, even though they're, you know, there's a formidable center of Islam, and you know, billions of people identifying as Muslim. I mean, it's to ask religion to separate itself out from the rest of our culture and politics, and I don't think you can do that.
So we're literally just about out of time. We had like 2 minutes left in the segment. I wish we had more, because we have not gotten into the pieces about deeply enough about his socialist thinking, his anti-imperialist thinking, his anti-colonialist thinking. But Peniel Joseph, a final thought, because we do have to wrap up in like 90 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is on the 50th anniversary of Malcolm's assassination, and on May 21st, it's going to be, Malcolm's...
19th, I thought, right?
May 19th.
Right.
February 21st and May 19th. It's going to be Malcolm's 80th birthday. It's from 90th birthday from 1925, 1915. It's a look at his legacy. His legacy of political activism reverberates in the Black Lives Matter movement. And to not marginalize Malcolm away from being an actual political organizer, this idea that Dr. King was the organizer and Malcolm was just the critic, whereas Malcolm organized black radicals globally at the local level in Harlem and all throughout these different cities in the United States, certainly at the national level starting in the late 1950s, and then in the international level as well. So if we look at these new movements that are resisting state violence, that are resisting racial oppression and economic injustice, we see that Malcolm X's call for a radical human rights movement that would connect all these movements, including civil rights. And I think the caller talking about women, I mean, feminism is part of that movement. And certainly I think we should have a robust movement for black feminism, which we do in this country. But that has to be connected with this black revolution and Pan-African revolution that Malcolm sought. So I think he's more relevant now than ever in the 21st century, and it's important for us to not to try to pigeonhole him or his legacy.
I want to thank all of you for being here. This has been a great discussion. You just heard Dr. Peniel Joseph, professor of history over at Tufts University, author of numerous books, which we'll post on our webpage, like Stokely Alive, Dr. Uhuru Williams, professor of history at Fairfield, author of Black Politics, White Power, and Michael Denzel Smith, who is the Nobler Fellow of the Nation Institute and writes The Nation and many other journals. Thank the three of you so much for bringing Malcolm X's life to life here for this last hour on the Mark Steiner Show. I appreciate you all deeply.
Thank you.
We're going to take a very brief break. We're really ending the show now, but I wish we were breaking coming back. We can't. We have to take a break. The Netflix show coming up behind us. We're going out here with a little bit more Nina Simone, Old Baltimore, one of my favorite songs she ever did. On the way out of here, reminding you, Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by the Maryland State Education Association, where you can learn about important issues affecting Maryland students, parents, and schools at their website, MarylandEducators.org. That's MarylandEducators.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern and day in history research producer is Sianna Greaves. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. And as we leave you with Nina Simone under us, to broadcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, please visit us at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. Waiting for a train.